This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
When I was doing field work in China in 2012, I met a family. We'll call them the Wang family to protect their real identities. They ran a little shop not too far from where they lived in a city that's on China's east coast. In late 2011, the man in the family, we'll call him Mr. Wang, was injured pretty seriously and couldn't work as a result of that. His wife became the sole breadwinner, and she had to care for both Mr. Wang and her 9-year-old son. And she did what many would do in her situation. She turned to the Chinese government. In particular, she requested assistance from the DBAL program, which is a common term for China's minimum livelihood guarantee scheme, or 中国最低生活保障. Unfortunately for Mrs. Wang, when she tried to apply for the benefits, the program administrators didn't even let her apply. They just turned her away. They said her family had no chance of getting the benefits and applying would just be a waste of time. They told her instead she could take on another second or a third job. She could turn to her extended family and relatives to borrow money from and to get support from. This was a story that I actually heard a lot when I was doing field work. But what was striking is that really close by to where the Wang family lived, just like something like a 10-15 minute walk in another neighborhood, same city, I met a different family. We'll call them the Li family, who recently qualified for DBAL. And what's striking is that program administrators, instead of turning them away, were very proactive in helping them obtain the DBAL benefits. They walked them through all of the paperwork, made sure nothing was missing, and they got the benefits, which amounted to a few hundred yuan a month, as well as other subsidies and benefits like housing subsidies, free health exams, reduced utilities costs, other intermittent cash, and in-kind benefits. And they're extremely helpful for the Li family, who are in a similar economic situation as the Wang family. Mrs. Li was the only one working, and they had to support a school-aged child. So both of these families faced really severe financial difficulties. The adults relied on part-time, informal, sometimes seasonal jobs that didn't provide any health or other benefits. Both had a young child to support. They lived in the same district of the same city, and they were seeking funds from the same pool. Neither had any particular sort of special relationships with the government. They didn't have any family or friends with anyone in the local government or know any local administrators. So the question that motivates my book is, what accounts for their very different treatment that they receive?
Okay, thanks, Jen. So hello, everybody. Welcome to the New Books in Economics. We're a podcast channel from the New Books Network. I'm Peter Lawrenson, Associate Professor of Economics at the University of San Francisco. My guest today, who I just had give you a little cold open for fun, is Jennifer Pan. She's an assistant professor in the communications department at Stanford University. She did her PhD at Harvard University in political science and has been a pathbreaker in applying new data science methods to the study of politics, especially with Chinese language text data. So to back up a little bit from the story she just told us, here in the US, there's a lot of talk about things like universal basic income. And in the world of development economics, there's been a lot of research done on conditional cash transfers and how that relates to unconditional cash transfers as a tool to help people get out of poverty. So today, what we're going to learn about is China's sort of version of these things, the minimum livelihood guarantee. The full name in Chinese is the Zuizhi Shenghuo Baozhang, but everyone calls it the Dibao for short. If you know China, of course, you won't be surprised to learn that power and politics matter as much as poverty in determining who gets access to these funds. So, Jen, before we get back to explaining the situation of the Wang and the Li families, why don't you tell us more about your background, how you started working on China and on this research topic?
Yeah, so I came into the PhD program at Harvard after working for a number of years, mostly in management consulting, but also in economic development. And a lot of that time was spent working in China, where most of my work was focused on public health, but also dealing with issues of inequality, redistribution, and economic development. And so going into my PhD program, this question of redistribution, social policies, was something that had always interested me. A lot of my other research has gone in a different direction, focused more on kind of information controls, media, etc. But going into the PhD, one of my core interests was to explore this aspect of Chinese politics and what accounts for the policies that were put forth, how they were implemented, and how distribution was actually happening on the ground.
Okay, so for this book, you used a lot of different approaches. Can you give us a quick overview? We'll go into more of the details later, but just like how did you go about researching this topic? What are some of the different kinds of information and data that you gathered and used?
I used a lot of different types of sources, including a lot of field interviews, analysis of speeches and policy documents at all levels of government. But in addition, I conducted an online field experiment among all of China's county governments, as well as an original survey of 100 neighborhoods in a few cities throughout China. And then on the kind of more computational side of things, I analyzed all announcements related to Dibao over a few year period and analyzed millions of social media posts to identify protests related to welfare as well as other types of protest events. So using kind of this pretty diverse range of empirical sources, I kind of are trying to use as much as I can to support the various arguments that form the book.
Great. Yeah. So we'll go into, what exactly you found out with each of those topics. But that's definitely a really exciting thing about your book that, as your opening story indicates, you did go out and, talk to real people and get their perspective on, what challenges they faced and, how the system worked for them. But then used a lot of different sources of quantitative data, many of which most of which you basically created yourself or generated yourself from existing documents, which especially these days, it seems like the environment for research in person in China is getting a lot harder. So, which is really unfortunate, I think, for oddly enough for China, because there's so many things where, even the Chinese government, from its most, in the most cynical interpretation, I think it needs other people in other countries to understand what's going on there and being able to be on the ground and actually talk to people. Obviously we do find out things that are unflattering, but having a more a fleshed out view and personalized view is important. But certainly many of us are moving more towards the kind of research, the other sources of research that you use, you know, because there is so much more information on the internet about what's going on in China that you can exploit.
So
now let's step back further. So we mentioned this is about the Dibao, about this sort of welfare system. Tell us more about how it started, when it started, how it works, or at least how it was supposed to work, and then how it's kind of evolved to the present.
Yeah, so Dibao is a means-tested, non-conditional cash transfer program. So what that means is, on paper, everyone whose household per capita household income falls below a certain locally set level, which is called the Dibao line, should be eligible to receive these monthly cash subsidies that bring their per capita household income to that Dibao line. The program is not conditional, so that contrasts with conditional cash transfer programs where, you know, the households only receive the benefit if they do certain things like send their children to school, vaccinate their children, etc. Dibao is supposed to be non-conditional. It's just if you're below your household per capita income below a certain line, then you're supposed to get the cash benefit. It's the largest such program in the world in terms of population covered. And based on the existing research, it's one of the few non-regressive social welfare programs in China. So there are many other social welfare programs that's been put into place in the last few decades in China, like health insurance. But those other programs tend to privilege the wealthy over the poor and actually increase income inequality. So Dibao is somewhat unique in that sense that it is non-regressive. And it's administered by China's civil affairs system, so the Minzheng system. It's funded, like many other social welfare programs, by both the central and local government, but the local governments are responsible for many aspects of the implementation, like setting the Dibao line. And Dibao the program first came about in the 1990s. It was piloted in certain cities in the early to mid 1990s and then rolled out nationally toward the end of the 1990s. In the 2000s, it really increased in terms of the size of population coverage, but in the past few years, the number of recipients has generally stayed about the same. And as of 2017, there were about 12.6 million urban Dibao recipients. I should mention that Dibao covers both urban and rural regions, but my book focuses primarily on the urban Dibao. So in terms of, you know, China's population, that's slightly less than 1% of China's population who are receiving urban Dibao as of 2017.
Okay, so you mentioned, so it's not regressive, and obviously, you know, was put in place at a time when a lot of the kind of social safety nets or supports that existed in the socialist system were kind of being dismantled. You know, you no longer had that iron rice bowl of a factory job that you could inherit from your parents and, you know, expect to have your whole life. And so, you know, it's natural that they would, or maybe not natural, but good, that certainly that they put in something to replace it. If it's not regressive, you did mention that the Dibao line is set at each local level. Is that by city or by province? And how does that work? Does that mean, is it adjusted by cost of living or by the budget that each, you know, place happens to have available? I mean, certainly even in the US, you know, things like school districts, right? There's a lot of inequity that comes about because local areas have to support public services with the budgets that they have. So if you're in a poor area, you get less social services. Is right. That issue in China as well?
In terms of who sets the Dibao line, the city or the prefecture sets it, and then below the city level at the county or district level, they can adjust it within a certain boundary up or down, depending on the locality. So that's supposed to be, you know, locally set to account for differences in cost of living. And if you look at the policy documents that the Ministry of Civil Affairs has put out over time, they're trying to push localities to have a more standardized way in which they set the Dibao line. But what really happens is that in almost all localities, the Dibao line is pegged to minimum wage and unemployment insurance. And it always goes minimum wage, and lower than minimum wage is unemployment insurance, and lower than unemployment insurance is the D-ball line. And so in reality, there's a lot of historical kind of path dependency to the level of the D-ball line, and changing the D-ball line usually necessitates changing both unemployment insurance and minimum wage.
Okay, so they're all kind of linked together.
Right.
And at least nominally going by local cost of living, although I'd imagine there may be some pressures on local governments that never seem to have quite as much cash as they'd like on hand to
yeah.
keep it lower if they are having trouble paying for other things.
Exactly. And so I found a lot of disconnect between the D-ball line and who actually receives benefits. It's not the case that everyone whose household, whose income falls below the D-ball line receives those benefits. In fact, there's been research over time done by the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences, China's Bureau of Statistics, that shows something like 60 to 80% of households whose income falls below the locally set line do not receive D-ball. And so that really echoes the kind of story of the Wang family that I kind of told at the beginning of this session.
Yeah. So why don't we get into that, right? So it's supposed to be, you know, at least on the sort of prefectural level, something like universal basic income, but you're saying 60 to 80% of people who ought to, according to the means testing, be getting it are denied.
Right.
And not just because they don't know to fill out the forms or to ask, but in some cases, like the one you gave, they are literally going up and saying, here I am, I'm below the line, help me out. And they're getting a no. So, mm-hmm. So why is that? And if they're not just taking care of the poorest, then what are they doing with this policy?
Yeah. So I would say they are taking care of the poorest, but specific subsets of the poorest. And what I found is that, and what I argue in the book is that there's two different logics of distribution, facing local governments that have this hard budget constraint, as you have brought up. So local governments don't have unlimited funds. They're not able to fully fund the D-ball program. And so they give D-ball to those who kind of meet that, whose income do fall below the D-ball line, but of two types. So the first type is to give D-ball to individuals who cannot participate in the labor market. So this can be the elderly, the disabled, whose household per capita income falls below this line. And because of the hard budget constraint, that means not all impoverished households can be funded. And if you're poor and you can work, then you're turned away from the D-ball program. When I was first doing my field work, I heard that logic explained to me many times. But what I find is that there's actually a second kind of logic to who gets D-ball. So again, it's people whose incomes are falling below the D-ball line. But instead of being those who cannot participate in the labor market, the second group of people are those who the Chinese government sees as potential future threats to political order. And the core programmatic features of the policy, D-ball policy, are never violated, but they're given to specific populations, in particular targeted, what are called targeted populations or 重点人口, who are individuals the Chinese government doesn't have sufficient evidence to prosecute for crimes, but who are placed under quite intensive surveillance and sometimes other control measures so that they can be monitored and so that the regime can preempt them from doing anything criminal, quote unquote, in the future. What this means is that if you belong to a targeted population and you're poor, your per capita household income is below that D-ball line, local administrators will work very hard to get you D-ball. And that's what was happening with the Li family, who were very proactively assisted in getting the benefit.
So if you're saying if you're a troublemaker, you'll be rewarded. Is that kind of what I'm hearing?
So if the government thinks you will be a troublemaker in the future, you are given these material benefits. But I think there's kind of two key parts of that. One is D-ball benefits. The D-ball line is quite low. This is a very minimal benefit. It's extremely helpful to impoverished households, but it is not a kind of very robust material reward. So even though households are getting this material benefit, in many ways, this additional kind of material resources are not allowing for something like social mobility, but rather keeping the poor poor, if that makes sense. That's one thing. The second thing is who are kind of potential troublemakers? The targeted population program is an attempt by the Chinese government to be able to identify future threats to the regime, but like Minority Report, whether you've seen the movie or read the short story. But there are no psychics. And so many of the people who are placed into this category of targeted population are those who have some distinguishing characteristic in the past. In particular, they've been released from prison or re-education reform or some sort of detention. So kind of these two points. One is to define what is a troublemaker, and second is to make clear that being given a material benefit is not necessarily a reward, in the sense that rewards are kind of helping you elevate yourself in some way. That's not necessarily happening with this material benefit.
So it's not the Chinese version of the sort of legendary American welfare queen who's collecting social benefits and living the high life.
It's not. Although I would say in China, there is opposition to D-ball because of that perception that it will decrease incentives to work. And so that's why I think you have that first kind of logic, which is if you're poor, but you seem like you can work, then you're not going to get D-ball.
Can you give us a sense, like how low is it? And obviously, even because cost of living is very different from China to here, and also varies hugely from like city to city or with the countryside. But like, could you give us a reference point or example of like how bad is it or how little is it?
Yeah, so I think something on average for urban D-ball is something like $2 a day. But when you look across cities, what you'll find is that the D-ball line tends to be lower than average household expenditures on food, like food only. So D-ball is supposed to be covering, you know, food, clothing, shelter, like very basic living expenses. And that total amount is below what a household in that same city would spend just on food alone.
Okay. So yeah, that's a great comparison point. And $2 a day is, you know, one of the various global standards for poverty that's been used as well. So that's a good reference point that, you know, that's the same standard of like really, really dire poverty that we use, you know, in looking at, much less prosperous countries in Africa, let alone in China, which, you know, on the whole has experienced really, really rapid growth and people are a lot better off. So yeah, so not great, but I guess not surprising to hear that in China, just like everywhere, there's always a sense that, you know, do those people really deserve it?
Right.
And so you're saying in a sense the government is kind of going in and like, you know, someone shows up asking for money and they give them the once over. It's like, yeah, you know, you still got both your legs, get out there and, you know, get yourself a job.
Right. That's right. But then
if that same person shows up, but is, you know, an ex-con or something like that, then, which, you know, I mean, that's an issue, you know, it's hard for people with that kind of situation, in any country to find work for a variety of reasons. So that's not completely unfamiliar logic, even from a U.S. perspective.
Yeah. And I think the maybe a difference is that, and I should say there is kind of, it absolutely makes sense from a kind of social policy perspective to give resources to those who are, have been formally incarcerated to try to reintegrate them into society. But I think the kind of second logic of distribution is slightly different than that. And even the kind of example that you give, that someone who is ex-con would approach the program administrator and ask for the benefit, that doesn't really happen. Usually what happens is that these targeted populations are already under kind of surveillance and being managed by a committee. And what if they realize that this household can be eligible for DBAL and any other benefit, then those resources from the state are kind of leveraged as a means of what I argue in the book, as a means of exerting more control and getting more transparency and information about.
Yeah. So tell me about that. You use the phrase repressive assistance. I mean, when you say like, oh, there's a committee that watches over you after you get out of jail or whatever, and then says, hey, here's some, you know, some social benefits you could access. That sounds super nice. And, you know, there's people who are very well-meaning, who that's their job, you know, in every major city and country in the U.S. So why is this an aspect of repression? I think you also emphasize that aside from just being, you know, a very penurious, like small amount, you don't see it as primarily a co-optation kind of thing where you're paying off people who otherwise would make trouble. Tell me more about repressive assistance.
Yeah. And I would say, I think a lot of the people who are carrying out the program, they see themselves as doing good. They don't see themselves as agent of a violent state that's engaged in repression. So why do I say that the provision of DBAL to try to preempt disorder is repressive? So yes, we usually associate repression with violence, physical sanctions, or at the very least, some sort of physical force like intimidation or surveillance. But I think we also need to remember that why is repression used? If we go to older definitions of repression, it's any action by a group which raises a contender's costs of action, and in particular, collective action. So what repression does, and traditionally we think it happens through by generating fear, is that it makes someone less able to take a particular action that they actually want to take. And why I call this form of assistance repression is that is because the provision of these material benefits creates repeated and frequent interactions between the government and the target of repression, and at the end of the day makes those individuals less able to take actions that they would otherwise have pursued. And I think this is where it differs from co-optation. And I recognize that co-optation, the term co-optation, is used very differently by different people. But we can think of co-optation in a more kind of basic sense as an exchange where a target accepts benefits and willingly forgoes some specific activities. So a target will decide, okay, I'm going to take these benefits because their value is worth some change in my behavior. In contrast with repressive assistance, the distribution of benefits, as I mentioned, makes recipients more legible or visible to the government, more dependent and more obligated to the state. And ultimately, they're not just less willing, but less able to engage in the activities that the government doesn't want them to engage in. And so there's no exchange going on. And I think that goes back to kind of the situation in which these people get the benefits. They are often just offered the benefits. And when you're offered the benefits, they're not in a position to turn it down, nor is it really clear what action they're supposed to forego if they receive those benefits. But it's after receiving the benefits and in the interactions that follow with the state that they are kind of less able to take actions and less able to act in ways that they might otherwise have acted in had they not been a recipient of the benefit.
So flesh that out for me, like make it more concrete. So there's some person who the party is concerned will be a troublemaker, and so they've been keeping an eye on them anyway and kind of watching them through various methods at their disposal. And then they show up at his house and say, okay, now we're going to give you this $2 a day benefit. And how does that increase their ability to monitor them? because they have to like come back and like register to like collect the money.
So even just to apply, so it's like, oh, there's this, someone could come to your house and say, there's actually this great benefit. You can get money. You can get these, you can get free exams. You can get rice before the Chinese New Year. Like there are all these little benefits that you can get. And all you have to do is give me all your information about employment, how much money you make from any particular job, what everyone in your household does. We'll also interview your neighbors to ask more about you. We'll post information about you in the neighborhood so anyone else who knows information about you can share it with us. And then we'll come check on you frequently to make sure you're doing okay. So
there must be a lot of social stigma if it's like, and you're not just getting your welfare check. It's like they're saying, okay, here's your welfare check, and we're going to put a big sign on your door or at the, you know, on the corner of your street saying, by the way, this is guy is getting a welfare check, and this is how much he's getting, and it's because he's so darn poor. Look here.
There is a lot. So there's been work by Chinese academics as well as others in the U.S. like Dorothy Solinger, who show that there's a huge amount of stigma attached to being a DBAL recipient, because in the application stage, there are these notices that are posted so that if anyone has objections, they can raise them. And then if you're a DBAL recipient, in every neighborhood, there's a bulletin board of all DBAL recipients, their name, sometimes the amount of cash transfers that they're receiving. So it's quite marginalizing and stigmatizing. But again, it's not necessarily clear when, you know, these extremely marginalized and impoverished households, when they're approached with this, do they really have the ability to say, no, I don't want this extra cash that you're offering, even though it's very low, I'm going to turn it away. I think most households are not able to say that because it's hard, kind of at the onset, it's not clear that you see all of the downstream consequences of taking that benefit.
Right. So it's, kind of a weird, just thinking it's like kind of a weird combination of like getting welfare and being put on the sex offender registry or something. Like right. Suddenly everyone knows who you are and their attention is drawn to you. Okay. All right. So let's talk more about the methodology. And actually, you know, I think you assembled five different data sets for this study. Probably hard in the time we have to even get through all those. So why don't we jump ahead to the one you assembled about protests and tell me like what you did with that, and then why you how that analysis of protests relates to this DBAO as a tool of social control, and then the conclusions you drew from that.
So it's kind of a related but somewhat separate project, in the sense that I think even putting aside this Brook project, for a country like China or kind of many other countries, social mobilization, protest, collective action, understanding how that happens, when that happens, the frequency at which it happens is really important for understanding that country, both for kind of how socially, politically, economically. But we really lack any sort of fine-grained information about protests and collective action. In China, this is true. I think many people have been working to try to ameliorate the situation. And we are one of those kind of groups of people who wanted to get more information about protests. And the way we approached it is to use social media data, recognizing that with the kind of explosion of digital media platforms in China, protesters turn to these platforms to share information about their kind of contention and protest events. And so taking advantage of that, we created a classifier or a classification system, which takes social media posts, both the text of the post as well as associated images, if there are any, and using different deep learning algorithms, identifies social media posts that talk about offline, on the ground, protests and collective action events.
Which social media were you using? Because I mean,
we used Weibo.
Okay.
So we use Weibo data because it is public, And so it's much easier to collect than something like Weixin. Also with the recognition that for many protesters, they're trying to get broader attention for their causes and for their demands. And so a platform like Weibo that is open is much more, has the kind of characteristics that would allow for that, better allow for that attention.
Right. I was definitely thinking that, right? Because Weixin or WeChat is these days, like, you know, everyone you talk to, like, that's the dominant platform. That's how everyone communicates. But I see your point that, you know, if your goal is to draw attention to yourself and gather support and put pressure on the, you know, on the government to deal with whatever your grievance is, then using Weibo, which is for non-China people, is sort of China's Twitter, is how it's usually summarized. That's going to get out there, so it can be, you know, recirculated most easily, and everyone can hear about it.
Yeah, and we do find kind of limitations. So our data, the resulting data, which covers a several year span and covers almost all regions of China, do not cover Western minority ethnic minority regions. And so there could be different reasons for that. It's because we were looking at Chinese kind of Chinese language content. It could also be because there are much more stringent limitations on use of internet and social media in those regions. But for kind of these various reasons, the data that we have is much more applicable to kind of Han Chinese regions and of China.
Yeah, I mean, it's unfortunate, you know, given the level of concern and awareness now there is now about you know, the what's happening in Western China, that unfortunately a lot of the time it's when you're doing research on China, you've kind of got to decide, like, am I going to look at kind of the main Han part of China, you know, central and eastern China, which is kind of one thing, or am I going to look at the other parts, which, yeah, right, are going to have a lot less data, and they just face a much, much more repressive environment. And yeah, it's a lot harder to figure out what's going on there. So often we do end up segmenting them and kind of neglecting them if we're focusing on the, you know, the majority population.
Yeah. 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 I think that's definitely a trade-off. And I think so. And one that we kind of, we're very transparent about when we were putting this data set together, and where kind of it reveals that even though we have so much data on social media, there's going to be systematic biases. And so even though protest event detection from traditional media is very limited, those types of data sources can actually be very complementary and reveal different types of kind of protest events that you wouldn't see on Chinese social media. And so for the purposes of the book, I use this resulting data to try to understand the effects of distributing Dibao in a very, in this instrumental way to preempt disorder. And so I look at the kind of city prefecture level, cities which have more policies linking Dibao provision to targeted populations. Is there a difference between those cities in terms of the level of protests overall, as well as protests related to welfare? And what I find is that in cities where there are more policies that kind of link Dibao to this kind of preempting threats to political order type situation, we actually see more welfare-related protests. And the reason for that is that it seems this type of distribution, this logic of distribution that's to preempt threats, leads to backlash. And people are backlashing not because they're upset about anything repressive, but rather they are upset about who is deserving or not deserving of welfare benefits. And this is, you know, so I'm seeing this pattern in the social media data, but also in my kind of neighborhood survey-based data, where in neighborhoods where more of Dibao benefits are more likely given to, for example, ex-prisoners, there are a lot more complaints, both individual and collective, to the neighborhood kind of administrators about whether that's fair distribution, whether those recipients are deserving or who else should be deserving of these benefits.
So that logical chain makes sense to me, but then I guess, so you know, the other issue is, especially at the aggregate level, you know, how much can you say that it doesn't go the other direction, that, you know, if there's more, you know, places that knew, that had, or that were anticipating more social disruption, said, oh shoot, we've got a problem, or maybe they even already had something going on, or maybe they just knew it was coming down the road, and then they say, okay, we've got to, you know, forget about giving money to everyone deserving because we can't anyway, so let's just focus on the ones we really think are going to be trouble.
Yeah, no, it definitely could go the other way, or probably there's some sort of feedback system that's going on. And one of the other things that I talk about in the book is kind of how did China arrive at this situation where a program that's supposed to be building a social safety net becomes used so instrumentally to try to maintain stability, what the Chinese government calls stability. And there, I think it has to do with how overall in China, the kind of understanding of what stability means, as well as how the government pursues it, has changed in the past few decades. But of course, I think different regions in China there's variation between different regions. So it could very well be the case that kind of this particular mindset around stability is stronger in some regions in China than others.
So how does, other people have been talking about, you know, there's the whole, in the Xi Jinping era, there's been obviously a greater, let's say, focus on stability, or, you know, more increased repression, you know, depending on what context, but also going along with this, at least, you know, some serious people argue that there's been a continuing development of sort of rule, you know, rule by law, right? You know, documenting things, formalizing things, leaving less things in the discretion of local leaders, you know, in many cases, because in the past they could be, you know, they might be corrupt, or they might kind of overreact, or to achieve some goal that they interpret as being desirable by the central government. And so they've tried to formalize stuff. But here, this seems like a movement kind of away from that. Like they had something with a very clear formal rules, and then just people kind of drifted on their own, like saying, oh, hey, I can just use this.
So I actually think both of the things you highlight are at work. So, I mentioned before the DBAO program is run by the Ministry of Civil Affairs. It's definitely not the case that the Ministry of Civil Affairs decided one day they would distribute DBAO in this particular way to preempt threats to social stability. And it's also not the case that local governments decided, hey, let's buy off people of DBAO. The reason why DBAO is distributed in this way, I think, runs much broader and deeper, and has both to do with kind of the kind of emphasis on stability, as well as kind of this let's stick to the rules sort of orientation. So I think most people, when we talk about stability and kind of where does that term come from in China, many people might think about Deng Xiaoping and, you know, a particular quote of his from 1989, where he says something like, you know, to China's problems, the priority is stability. If we don't have stability, nothing can be achieved, and everything that will be achieved will be lost. But I think what's maybe harder to remember is that at that point, when Deng was talking about this, the ultimate objective was not stability, it was economic modernization. And stability was kind of seen as a necessary condition. And so the idea was, you have economic reform. That economic reform is going to lead to social unrest. That unrest can hinder economic progress. And so you need to manage that unrest with developing a kind of systematic social security system, like a social safety net. But I think that kind of viewpoint of the relationship between economic development, stability, and social security was supported by the type of protests that happened in China in the 1990s, like mostly laid off workers, pensioners who were protesting. But then what I find is that after the Falun Gong protests in 1999, which was not about economic rights, but more about social political rights, the CCP changes its thinking about stability. And in particular, instead of thinking about kind of instability as a result of economic development becomes seen as a way of maintaining stability, right? That's the whole performance legitimacy idea. Mm-hmm. But that's like a really fundamental shift in the causal story. Instead of thinking economic development will lead to instability because privatization is hard, for example, the story is you must have economic development to have stability. So like that's a totally different kind of causal story and idea. But what I find is that this new idea that you need, the goal is now stability and you need economic growth as a condition for stability kind of takes hold throughout the 2000s. And it's also accompanied by how the Chinese government pursued stability. So there's this policy of comprehensive management of public security. So, 社会治安综合治理. So after Tiananmen Square, that came about. And so it was a replacement of strike hard campaigns. But after Falun Gong protests in 1999, this strategy of comprehensive management of public security expands beyond the security apparatus. So basically, there's a policy document that says we can no longer rely on public security to ensure stability, but instead, all functional bureaucracies need to be involved in ensuring stability. So that specifically named is the civil affairs system, but also others like labor, social security, education, health, family planning. Like every functional bureaucracy is involved in stability, and so that's why with something like DBAL, nothing on paper is changed about the program. The formal kind of rules of the program are never violated. So that's where the kind of law, rule of law kind of orientation comes in. But instead, what you have is policy documents from the security apparatus saying anyone who's applicable, who's like eligible for benefits, but who are being, you know, sent in community re-education or targeted population should receive the benefit. So it's that kind of a changing priority of who should be first in line to get these benefits given hard budget constraints, which changes the allocation of resources in the program without ever changing or violating the formal rules.
So the DBAL line is not really, I mean, how is it phrased in the laws? Like, is it supposed to be a guarantee? Or is it more like, if you're below this, then maybe, I mean, in practice, it sounds like if you're below this, then maybe if we feel like it, we'll give you this money, but you're not guaranteed it. But how does that actually...
On paper, yeah. It is, if you're below this line, then you should get the benefit. I think the ambiguity comes in that many local governments have added additional kind of conditions, requirements, assessments on top of that. So it's like, how do you assess income? Should assets be, like, for example, like assets, should assets be calculated as part of income? Usually we would say no, right? But a lot of local governments have also said, well, income's really hard to assess, especially for people who are working informally. So let's look at their assets. And some, I've seen policy documents in some localities, like if you have a car or if you have this particular type of asset, then no matter what we think your income is, you're not eligible. So there are a lot of these kind of layers to eligibility that make it a little bit more complicated exactly who is below the line set by the local government.
Okay. So yeah, I mean, I guess that's generally true. Again, something that's familiar if you work on China and less familiar if you're not, that like there's all these grand plans at the top level, but there's a lot of flexibility at the local level, which is understood by everyone as being, you know, kind of basically legitimate, like this weird kind of quasi-federalism or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
All right. So it's interesting. I mean, it's always a little bit arbitrary when you make, you know, critical junctures or dividing lines or whatever, but you know, you put the 1999 Falun Gong protests kind of as one, you know, in a lot of things people are looking at now, often something around 2012, you know, when Xi Jinping came into power is often viewed as a dividing line. How do you see, because your research kind of spanned that that transition from who to Xi. So do you see do you feel like the trends you saw in your book have just pretty much continued from the early Xi period, or have there been exacerbated or changed? Like how is it things developing?
Yes, I would say one important thing is that the trends that I see started absolutely before the C period. One example would be the targeted population program. That's actually been in place since 1950. The exact categories of who should be under surveillance has obviously changed. But this is an active program before Xi Jinping came into power. And so instead of seeing 2012 as a kind of change in kind, if anything, I would say it is a kind of change in, potentially a change in degree. And there are two aspects to that. One is that Xi has made poverty alleviation a really big part of his kind of agenda. Most of it has been focused on rural poverty alleviation. I think there's some question of, you know, how will urban poverty and kind of programs like the urban Dibao fit into that going forward. So I think kind of there's this overall emphasis, renewed emphasis on alleviating poverty at the kind of programmatic policy level. And then at the same time, everybody kind of, there's a kind of general perception that there's a renewed emphasis on stability and the importance of stability. But there, I think it's really about just more of the same. Comprehensive management of public security has not gone away. If anything, it's become more expansive. And so I would say the kind of things that I identify in the book are not appearing after 2012, but definitely trends that we see continuing from before.
Okay. No, that makes sense. And yeah, I think sometimes on the one hand, Xi Jinping does seem to be a very different character from what people before him, but there's also ways in which I think people kind of overstate how things now can sometimes feel more new. But actually, if you've known China for a while and you look at the development, you see a lot of commonalities or a lot of common themes, which maybe are implemented differently in different eras, even if sometimes the goals are the same. Just actually this week, as we're recording, there was a huge thing with Didi's IPO. After Didi's IPO, then new regulations, which I mean are all still developing, so I won't actually explain them, but new regulations putting more control over all the digital data that Chinese companies are now able to gather about Chinese citizens. So let me just take that as an opportunity to lead in, like, this surveillance you're talking about, where like you have to come hat in hand to like collect your check or your physical cash or whatever it is, each month or week, and then they, get to ask you questions and like post a sign on your street about where you've been and what you've done and all these kinds of things. That seems very old school, right? So now, if we have cameras in every corner and your phone's going to track you anyway, then is that changing the system or will it change the system? What do you see happening? And to the extent that you're willing to guess or forecast, how do you think that will evolve?
Yeah, so actually that's what that was one thing kind of to your previous question that I was going to say, that if there's any kind of more sharp change, it is that this kind of digital surveillance. And while it's coincided with the rise of Xi, it's a technology change. So I think changes in digital technology, both for surveillance as well as for financial technologies, that definitely does have the potential to change how things are happening. But I'm not sure they will change the kind of fundamental political dynamics underlying why we see the particular characteristics of, for example, Dibao that we do. Because I think the political incentives will still be there as long as the Chinese government focuses so heavily on stability. But now it's possible to just have much more data and to put kind of larger portions of the population under under surveillance and monitoring. I think one open question that I really don't know the answer to is there a substitution of digital surveillance for this kind of grassroots human intensive surveillance? I'm not sure if that's the case, but I should also say that in kind of the book that I do, what I find is that the human level surveillance is really uneven between different neighborhoods and different communities. So maybe one change is that when you have digital surveillance, there's much more consistency across neighborhoods, districts, and cities.
Yeah, that makes sense. But yeah, no matter what, there'll be some surveillance. It's just a question of how is it going to be implemented. All right. So yeah, that's it's been really great talking to you about this. Just before we wrap up, I wanted to ask you, you're finished with the book that's out. I know you have a lot of other projects going on. Maybe you could just give us a sense of what some of them are. Do you have any next book project, or do you just have another 50 articles in the works?
Maybe there will be projects that turn into books, but I think for the most part, I'm working on papers. There's some group of kind of one area is continuing to focus on kind of censorship and propaganda and how the Chinese government is controlling different types of digital media platforms. We're looking at one project looking at Douyin or Chinese TikTok and Bilibili and other sort of video streaming platforms. And also then I'm also starting to look at how Chinese government is trying to influence opinion outside of China's borders. The one separate distinct area of research that might become a book, but I don't know, is looking at public opinion in China and how preferences are bundled, what influences preferences, both looking at the general population. But we have one particular project that's following Chinese college students in China and in the U.S., ideally, hopefully from freshman year through graduation. Currently they're juniors. So it's an observational study of how their attitudes, opinions, and behaviors are changing during this pretty formative period of time. And so that we're writing papers on that, but there maybe that'll become a book at some point. And then there's another kind of group of research that comes out of the book, but ties in with my other research looking at kind of the intersection between propaganda and repression and these kind of the strategies that the Chinese government uses to influence public opinion and behaviors.
Okay, well, that's really exciting. That's about all the time we have. So thanks so much for being on the show. I really enjoyed having this chance to talk more about your book.
Thank you so much for having me.